Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We welcome fashion consultant Bobby Schwartz to the show this week, talking about the importance of wearing the right clothes to work if you want to advance your career. Social media expert Patrick Charles discusses reality TV show contracts and how one-sided they are against the actual contestant. ER physician Dr. Zach Levine talks about taking care of your urinary system, and then we wrap things up speaking with talented musician Sabelle and hearing his great new track, Till the Sun Burns Out.
Capture your need for sound.
What's worse, dressing too young or too old? Is there even such a thing as dressing your age? How do you know what is appropriate for the office and advancing your career? There are so many questions when it comes to handling your wardrobe, and whether you want to believe it or not, how you dress does affect your life and career. To help give us some answers and advice on what to do is fashion consultant Bobby Schwartz, who has worked with some of the world's leading fashion houses, including Ralph Lauren and Neiman Marcus. Bobby, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me on, Kelly. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Bobby, when it comes right down to it, how important is your wardrobe and how you actually dress in life?
At work, it's a career breaker or maker, pure and simple. People make assessments on you literally in less than 2 seconds, and they've formed an opinion about you in 7 to 17 seconds, and over 55% of that is based on how you look. And in real life, you know yourself when you're out. You know, out and about, and you see someone, the way they're dressed, you make an assessment immediately.
What are some of the biggest mistakes that both men and women make when it comes to deciding on their wardrobe and style?
I think when it comes to professional dressing, it's really about quality. People think that it doesn't matter if you buy cheap clothes as long as they look okay, and it really isn't true. And there's a whole science to getting it so that you can work it into your budget. You know, there's just a whole lot of stuff that goes into it, but really quality is key. Men have it a little bit easier because they, of course, have an elected uniform that they wear. And so if they're in casual dressing, it's a different subject. But for just a regular, normal office environment where you're expected to dress, it is a little bit easier for men, but the quality issue absolutely applies. And for women, the biggest mistakes they make are showing too much cleavage, too short of a skirt, being unprofessional, and being in crummy clothes.
How do you actually right the ship if you've been dressing, you know, not up to par in your career? Can you actually really change how management maybe looks at you?
Absolutely. It's going to take a little bit of time because you know that it takes 7 positives to overcome 1 negative. So you've been living this for a while. You've already taught people who you are by how you're dressed, but you can fix it. It's always fixable. And I have a client, in fact, that exact same thing happened to. She's had, offers for promotions, and being interviewed now by some of the biggest competitors in her industry. So it makes a huge difference, and it is possible.
How should a person go about getting on track with their fashion sense?
The best way is to find a source that you trust. You know, go to a high-end boutique, even if you just want to kind of fish around and see what's there. My book is an excellent, excellent source because it just simply really lays it out. Specifically, women, you know, as women, we tend to get, you know, we're a little bit like creatures with shiny objects thinking, oh my gosh, look at that, I got to own it. Oh my gosh, it's on sale. And then we've got a closet full of clothes and nothing to wear. So this kind of helps you whittle that down, knowing that you're going to buy your essentials, get your basics, and then you can splurge later on once you've got the foundation to your wardrobe set. But, you know, I would try, you know, going to a high-end retailer of some sort and getting in there and asking questions. That will really help. And even if you've got to wait for sale, you know, somebody has to buy the sale, it might as well be you.
Joining us on the show is fashion consultant Bobby Schwartz, who has worked with some of the world's leading fashion houses, including Ralph Lauren and Neiman Marcus. Make sure to check out her website, thebobbyschwartzgroup.com. When it comes to women, the idea of, you know, showing too much skin, I think, seems to be an issue not only for, like, the 20-year-olds, but even the 40-year-olds. What's your position on this, Bobby?
It's don't show skin. I mean, and you know, one of the concepts that you brought up was dressing your age. It is repellent, ladies, for people to see you with massive cleavage and short skirts on when you should no longer be showing that skin because you're too old to do it. That is probably the number one mistake that older, more mature women make. And on the, with the younger girls, I don't know what you're trying to project when you do this. When you show a tummy, you show the cleavage, you show practically your hoo-ha because your skirt's so short. You know, at work, certainly, you're definitely sending the wrong message to management. And out in your social world, if you're just looking for a one-night stand, go for it. But if you want something more than that, believe me, men don't want to see it all the first time around unless they're going to sleep with you that night.
Is it true?
Does that help?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's really important for people to, you know, be aware of that because I think, well, actually, Bobby, what's your take on the woman's mindset in a way? Because sometimes I feel like, you know, whether it's the younger or the older, they think like, oh, if I do this, this might work in my favor.
Well, I think it's unfortunate because, you know, you're just not doing the right thing. You know, I remember seeing on the Blue Collar Comedy Tour, which, you know, it's kind of sketchy at best, but whoever was doing this was talking about being in Walmart and seeing these women and how repulsive it was to him. And I'm telling you, that's what the world is seeing, whether you think so or not. And for these young girls, just think in terms, if you've got, you understand the psyches of men. You know, they're very, very visual, and if that's what you're trying to attract as a one-night stand, then you're in the right place. But really, if you're looking for something more long-lasting and meaningful, you need to dress tastefully. And darling, I'm not asking you to dress like a frump, but don't show all the skin. Don't give all the goodies away in the first 5 minutes.
Is it true, depending on what you wear, you can actually come off as confident or clever or even someone that management wants to promote?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I teach it all day long in seminars. It shows up in my book. I talk about it on our blog and certainly on our member site. But that's how you're selling yourself to people. You know, men in really high-level positions, if you look at them, they are in their $2,000 shoes. Thank goodness, ladies, we don't have to spend that on shoes. But sadly, we do need more than one pair, or they can get away with one or two pairs. But that $6,000 suit, that image, and I'm promoting getting it at a bargain rather than doing full price, but that designer clothing in your shoes, your bags, and what you've got on, and your play clothes, cheat, go to Target, I don't care. But in your stuff where you're trying to make an impact on someone because you want a promotion, you want to do well, and you want to be acknowledged and recognized, you need to invest in your wardrobe.
You just briefly spoke about footwear. How important is shoes when it comes to what they say about you and just, I suppose, how you project yourself again at work?
It's all about the shoes. It's the beginning and the end of what they're seeing. People begin and end at your feet. It's the first tell and how well you're put together. And if you're in your Nine West shoes, you are not in the competition area for, you know, competing with these guys. They're just dismissing you out of hand in the first second because of what you've got on.
So what should you be wearing as a woman then?
Well, okay, so ladies, brace yourself. But it should be Christian Louboutin, Gucci, Manolo Blahnik, Jimmy Choo, that kind of quality of shoe. Again, sale is your friend if you're not one of those that, you know, can just go out and buy whatever you want. And if you can't, go for it. But if you've got a budget, then just pace yourself.
Can I ask you something, Bobby, as well? Like, I know with regards to women, you know, I guess the main thought is that people or women are always in some sort of heel. Do you have to be in a heel, like, at work? Because I know, for example, I have a friend of mine who, she has a bad back, she just can't do it. Like, she cannot do the heel
thing. No, you do not have to be in a heel. Let me, you know, and we probably both know this, and maybe your audience does as well. Taller people are more, project is more powerful. And so, you know, if you can do a heel, but if you, you know, if you've literally, if, let's say you're already 6 feet tall or you're 5'10", feel free to wear a ballet flat or some sort of flat. But if you definitely have, you know, issues, absolutely, a flat or there's also a really low heel, like an inch kitten heel that might not hurt her back, but would still give her the presence of having some sort of slight pump on if she needed just a little bit. But, you know, you got to work with what you've got.
Okay. Yeah, because I know that, you know, I'm sure that's a concern for many women that, you know, might have lower back problems or something and, like, just it's not
feasible.
Well,
and many women's, also their feet, the bunions and everything else that have come from years of doing, you know, they need to be comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so finding comfortable shoes, I think, is key. And, you know, you do what you can to do it and still stay within the boundaries of what's going to help your career.
Can you ever wear, Bobby, like, because, you know, there's lots of, like, I suppose it depends your work area, your work office environment. But, you know, for example, where I work in the radio, in a radio station world, we're sort of, you know, I think it's expected almost that we dress a little bit funky, if you will, you know, on occasion. So,
sure, absolutely.
So I, you know, I have like copious amounts of funky sneakers, for example. Is that something that you can, like, do you get dismissed if you're wearing like a sneaker? You know what I mean?
Yes, yes, I really kind of think you do,
okay,
in a way. And what there is a way, however, to do the clever and the funky and still pull it off as being, you know, professional on some degree. I would recommend like a more expensive pant, you know, a black trouser, you know, good, I mean, it could be skinny pant. It doesn't have to be, you know, wide leg pants, but so that it is funkier. You can, and what I tell people, you kind of have to play with this a little bit because this is, I think, going to require a little more time than we have. But you can put that sneaker, you maybe did that with a really rich-looking pair of pants, and you had a jacket on that, so it kind of had that finished, polished look when you got in there, even with your sneakers, and then you ditched the jacket, but they saw you come in it. And so you're doing a combination to make that happen.
Okay.
You know, and add the earrings in or, you know, some fun, funky bracelets with it, to really give yourself that extra twist so that you come off as being professional, but you get it about being funky.
Okay, got it. Joining us on the show, fashion consultant Bobby Schwartz. Make sure to check her out on her website, thebobbyschwartzgroup.com. Why do you say that handbags do not belong in the boardroom? What does that mean?
Well, essentially, we just kind of, it was a play on words. You can take your handbag, but the point is you can't go in there looking like a girl necessarily. I mean, we're not trying to dress you like a man, but you've got to be able to play with the big boys. And if you're going to the boardroom, you need to be attired in expensive clothing, expensive shoes, expensive bag, or use that bag to be more of a, you know, it's got your laptop in it or your pad, whatever it is, and you maybe doubling it as a briefcase. But the point is we're trying to make a point about coming in not looking too girly.
Okay. And what do you say for someone who is just starting off their career, like a young man, a young woman? What do you want to see them start off on the right foot with?
Total basics. Great pair of shoes, a great suit in the man's section. For the women, you can buy it all separately, the skirt, the pant, the suit, the jacket, and mix them all up. But just get those basics and then find your nearest designer discounter. So Neiman Marcus Last Call, Saks Off Fifth, all of them have an online presence, so if there's not one near you, but, you know, you can't at this point, unless you're, you know, still being, you're on the dole with the parents, you're going to need help getting out there and acquiring these things. You don't have a big budget, so getting them at a lesser price is absolutely a game saver, but it is absolutely worth the investment. You know, for most of your audience, they probably have, you know, through university, college, and they've invested in that education. Your investment is not over. Continue to invest. If you buy well, you're going to have it for years and years and years and years.
Yeah, I have a pair of pants that, like black pants that I've been able to keep for, I think I'm on year 7 or 8 with them. Like they just don't, because they're high
yep.
quality, they just keep going, you know?
Absolutely the truth.
Question for you as well, Bobby, with regards to accessories, how important are they?
Minimal. They're incredibly important to keep them at a minimum. You know, a guy's only going to wear a watch and he's done.
Right.
And for women, I would tell you small stud earrings, a fabulous watch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. No jewelry, any other jewelry. That's it, period.
And what is,
so
what
accessories
is your,
are incredibly important.
And what is
Don't
your take on like scarves and all that kind of stuff, like to sort of maybe switch up your outfit a bit?
Well, you know, you can do it. I'm not a big fan of the scarf for most people because I feel like it begins to junk up.
Okay.
You know, you've got to have all the right combinations in there. But it certainly can change things up a little bit. Rather than going that direction, I would just encourage people to get several good knit tops that would go under their jackets. This
mm-hmm.
is for women again because guys, they're in their uniform with their tie and their shirt.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll talk about that in a second. And with this, they just, you know, if you had the different underpinnings that you can put under your jacket, that's going to change the look up. and then you, because you're going to need a really good scarf if you're going to do this. You can't just buy some cheap thing. And I'd rather see the money go into tops that you can wear, you know, on a daily basis and swap around. For guys, all they need is a pale blue or a white shirt, and that's it. They don't need to get stripes. They don't need patterns. They don't need to do anything until they're ready to expand their wardrobe some.
And I wanted to ask you about your book. You know, talk to us about it and how it can help.
It is designed, as I mentioned, about the creatures and shiny objects thing. That's really addressed in the book, because the idea is that you want to be able to, you really want to build that foundation, solid foundation. It saves money, it saves time and stress. And you're just done. It doesn't matter where you get invited, whether it's the opera, the theater, the dinner, a cocktail party for work, whatever. You never are in a state of panic, because you've got everything you need for these important events. And it talks about how to acquire them, what you really are looking for. There's lots of pictures. I'm big on pictures because, you know, as they say, it's 1,000 words. And it really, truly just will help you really understand what it is to build an essential basic wardrobe and then be able to move on from that, but to be able to use it forever.
And where can people get a copy of the book?
You can go online. We are, you know, in the process of getting lots of things nailed down. So when you go to my website, it's on there and can be purchased either in a PDF version or a hardback. And the hardback is really lovely. So, you know, very interesting to put on your coffee table.
Fantastic. Bobby, thank you so much. It's been so much fun to have you on the show.
Thank you, Kelly, so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and it's been a lot of fun.
That's fashion consultant Bobby Schwartz. Again, to learn more about her, check out her website. Also, to grab a copy of her book, thebobbyschwartzgroup.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
We've always heard how bad recording contracts have been over the years, with a lot of unfair advantage being taken of the artists. With the recent leak of the contracts signed by contestants on The Voice, we see that once you throw reality television into the mix, things get a whole lot worse. To explain all of this, our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Patrick, thanks for hanging out on the show with us this week.
Anytime. How are you?
Good, good. So, you know, I know a lot of us have always heard about those terrible recording contracts, and we've obviously seen certain artists that have shown their displeasure, Prince being one of them, George Michael another. But now, what does this mean with regards to reality TV shows?
Well, it's crazy because this happened before, where a contract from American Idol got leaked, and it just showed you how much control the producers have over the contestants, how much of your life they take over afterwards. So we found out that a contract got leaked recently from The Voice, and it's pretty bad.
Really, eh?
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Like how bad?
Well, some of the terms that you agree to. First of all, the document is 30 pages long.
Wow.
So that's never a good sign.
No.
I can tell you that from previous experience. If a contract is that long, it's never a good sign. Yeah, they have the right to change the rules at any time.
They do?
Which is a pretty crazy thing when you think about it, right? Like, if you just imagine, that's the first thing on the contract. You're signing a contract. It's as if I say to you, hey, let's make a deal. I'm going to pick you up for work every morning at 8:45.
Yeah.
I'm going to buy you lunch, and I'm going to drive you back home. Good deal, right?
Yep.
In the contract, it says, I can change the rules at any time.
Wow.
it all of a sudden sounds not so great.
Yep.
So yeah, that's one of the major things in there. And they can eliminate contestants at any time, even if they are, in quotes, winning with the public.
Really?
Yes. And there's more. They can ignore the show's voting system, which includes sales figures for contestants, songs on iTunes, in the event of problems. So that means that, like, if you get a DUI and you're, like, the number one leading contestant on the show, mm-hmm. they can still, like, dispose of you in 2 seconds, and you can't sue them. You can't come back and say, oh, but I was doing well and you guys are hurting my career. So the contract is all in favor of the producers, basically.
Wow, that's intense.
Yeah, they also have the right to force contestants to undergo medical or psychological testing. And under certain circumstances, release the results on television.
What?
Yeah. So that means if you really go cuckoo, like if something really happens to you that would maybe make the show or NBC look bad, they can do a psych exam on you and then say, well, look, she's crazy.
Wow.
It's not our fault.
Do you think that would really stand up in court, Patrick, though? Like, I'm wondering, like, because, you know, I feel like in the States, everyone always wants to sue each other all the time. Like, I mean,
Right. Obviously,
I suppose it's binding on some level if they're going to these lengths to do that. But I almost feel like a judge would be like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, but the real problem is, though, is that you sign these things and it takes you a lot of time and money to fight them.
Right.
And if there's one thing that NBC and The Voice has, it's time and money.
Yes.
So you would have a really tough time disputing it. I mean, you'd be able to fight it in court, but would you be able to win? I mean, financially, and would it be a win for you? I mean, yeah, it would be really difficult.
And why would anyone sign this then? Like, it's terrible.
Well, it just goes to show you, like, I mean, how little of a chance people think they have. I mean, going to record companies and trying to get, you know, music released, trying to get famous, it's increasingly difficult. And I mean, that's where the desperation of these shows comes from. I mean, that's where the you know, the super long lineups of people trying to audition, that's where they come from. Because, I mean, these are people who really want to make, you know, they want to make it in the industry, and they see this as the only way, which it kind of is right now.
I know that. Obviously, a person in that position is trying to get ahead, and I suppose they would sign anything, right? To
exactly.
Take
that's
it themselves.
The problem.
Because I wonder, like, it was funny. Like, I ended up interviewing Philip Phillips a couple of weeks ago for the radio station I work for, and you know, he seems no worse for wear. He talks positively about the situation, but I almost wonder. I think it's been 2 years or three since he's won, and I still wonder what tentacles they have into him. You know, from American
Idol. He's still under contract, because normally you're under contract with them for like 7 years.
Really.
Yeah. So, like, once you've won the show, well, I'll tell you something else. I mean, like, somebody who leaves Saturday Night Live, which is produced by Lorne Michaels for NBC, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He's got a piece of everything you do for 7 years.
Anything you do.
Anything you do, anything at all for 7 years. And I'll tell you the short story as to why that is.
Okay.
And I'll tell you in two words: Adam Sandler.
Oh, okay. Explain.
Adam Sandler got fired from SNL.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he got fired because somebody in the entertainment department didn't like him, not because of Lorne Michaels. But so Adam Sandler got fired from SNL and then went on to be arguably one of the biggest box office draws in history,
wow.
Right? Which Lorne Michaels gets nothing from. So ever since Adam Sandler, every performer who's on SNL is tied to Lorne Michaels for 7 years afterwards, just to make sure you don't get too famous.
Wow. No wonder they all come back to visit then all the time.
Sure, because I mean you're under contract anyway, so you may as well. What happens is people have projects, and they bring them to him, mm-hmm. because you're already going to pay him anyway.
Right.
So they go to his. We're going on to an SNL tangent here, but like Fred Armisen, who does Portlandia for IFC, it's produced by Lorne Michaels' company. Fred left SNL. You may as well have Lorne Michaels producing the show because you're going to have to pay him anyway.
Wow. That's all the tentacles just still there, eh? That's crazy. Is NBC alone in this? Like, I guess the other networks would be doing this too, if you know, with regards to whatever show they would have.
Yeah, they all pretty much run the same way. But I want to tell you another clause that I thought was fantastic in this thing. There's a line in there that says that the network has they have to allow the producers to portray them in a false light. So if there's some story that they need to spin to make you seem sort of more sympathetic, maybe, or, you know, let's say you do something terrible and they want to say, well, we're going to say you came from a broken home, even though you didn't, you have to go along with it.
Oh my God, this is terrible.
Yeah.
I knew stuff goes on, you know, just because of what you and I both do for a living. Like we've
yeah.
been around the block, but I had no clue it was that bad. Not a clue. Nope.
It's pretty crazy.
As, has NBC responded to this? And by the way, is it even legal for them to be making up false backstories, you know, for example?
Well, I guess the thing is, here's the gray area. It's up to a judge to decide. But I mean, if you sign a contract going into it knowing that they may make something up, I guess, you know, what can you really say, right?
Wow.
You know, it's not illegal in the sense that it's not illegal to make up a story.
Right, okay.
Right? I mean, you know, celebrities make up stories and say, oh, you know, I grew up super poor or whatever, you know, to make themselves seem, you know, a little bit more sort of downtrodden.
Yeah.
But there's no law against it. I mean, is it unethical? Yes, but there's no law against it. So, I mean, if you sign a contract and NBC says, we may have to portray you in a different light, you know, to make you seem more favorable on television, and you agree with it, I don't think you can really do anything about it, you know? Because even if you, here's the interesting thing, like, even if you leak any of these documents to anyone, the show can sue you for between $100,000 and $1 million.
Oh my God.
So it's in your best interest not to even tell anybody what's in this contract, right? Because that's the problem.
And so has NBC responded to these leaked documents at all, or?
Yeah, they took there were a couple of people, I don't actually watch The Voice, but there were a few people that had strange things happen to them. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with the fact that like someone was taken off the show and they said that, they didn't count any of their social media votes because they saw inconsistencies in the voting.
No, I didn't hear about that.
So they just said, okay, we're not going to count any of those votes. Oh. And, you know, people thought that was pretty crazy. But this is, you know, all part of what they do. They need to manipulate things to make it go the way they want it to go. Because, I mean, got to remember, it's a TV show.
Yep.
Bottom line is it's a TV show. You know, people go, oh, it's a singing show. But yeah. Really, it's a TV show. Because If you came on and you were this, you know, fantastic person and you sang really well and you got a recording contract, that would be boring.
Yep.
Something has to be a shocker. Something has to happen. You know, I mean, you know, we watched American Idol for years, right? And you remember how, especially in the beginning, they used to show, you know, a girl who was like a single mom and a waitress.
Right.
And then, of course, she had the big voice when she got on stage, right? Of course, she was like the greatest singer in the world. They showed her whole story, where she grew up, how poor she was. She's got this kid. And then when she opens her mouth, it's a symphony that comes out. I mean, that's a TV show, right?
Yep.
You know? So they got to build it up. So, I mean, this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to make sure that they can spin things the way they want to spin them.
Well, thank you so much for sharing the light. Because like I said, I feel like I'm pretty savvy, but obviously not as savvy as I thought. So I think it's good for people to know what they're watching. Like, I think a lot of us are, you know, look at these shows with a grain of salt. But, it's funny. I did an interview the other day with an expert with regards to TV design shows. Because, you know, a lot of people get sucked into watching those do-it-yourself shows. And, you know, all of a sudden you think you can be, Debbie Travis or whatever doing these things. But, it's really important to realize that, you know, there's a lot of teamwork that goes into that that you're not seeing in the half an hour that they're showing you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I think it's really important that everyone, because, and it's like I said, I know about these things, but I still get sucked in. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. And then I'm like, wait a minute, that probably took a month, not 7 days, like they said, you know?
Yep.
Very good.
That's the way it goes.
Patrick, thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Again, make sure to follow him on Twitter @GetPatrick, and you can learn more about him on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
A topic that no one really wants to talk about in public, and even sometimes with their doctor, are problems with their urinary system. A lot of people feel self-conscious about the subject and would rather keep quiet than find out what's actually going on. Joining us to talk about all of this is Dr. Zach Levine. Dr. Zach Levine is an ER physician at the Montreal General Hospital. Dr. Zach, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks very much.
So let's, I guess, do the overview. What exactly involves the urinary system, if you will?
Yeah, well, so the urinary system basically starts up in the kidneys, which filter the blood and take out the toxins that they can. And in doing so, they make urine. And then the urine is funneled from the kidneys to the bladder and the ureter. And then from the bladder, it leaves us via the urethra. And, we can develop problems or difficulties in any and all of the places that I mentioned, so anywhere from the kidneys to the ureters to the bladder to the urethra. And the problems are very variable, you know. They can be infections, they can be stones, they can be cancers. So there's a lot to consider, and certainly I see in the emergency, and any primary care doctor sees a lot of urinary tract issues. And then, of course, there's a whole field of medicine called urology that deals with the urinary tract, and nephrology, which is all about the kidneys. So it's a complex system.
What are the most common, if we can call it that, urinary problems that both men and women can experience?
Well, certainly the most common, certainly in younger people and specifically in younger women, would be a urinary tract infection. So, a bladder infection or a urine infection, whatever you want to call it. That's very, very common. It's second only, I believe, to upper respiratory tract infections like cough and cold and bronchitis and flu, in terms of infections that primary care doctors, like family doctors, see. And it's relatively, most of the time, relatively benign. So in the sense that usually it doesn't kill people, but it does need to be treated, usually with antibiotics. And so, like I said, it's much more common in women, especially at younger adult women. It gets more common in men as they get older. And it's characterized, I'm talking about urinary tract infections like bladder infections. Typically, they're characterized by urinary frequency, so meaning the person has to go to the bathroom more often. There may often be burning on urination. Sometimes they can't get that much urine out when they do go to the bathroom. Sometimes there's some blood in the urine. And usually it's more concerning when the person starts to have back pain or severe fever or chills and vomiting, because the infection usually starts in the bladder, But if it goes up towards the kidneys, then it becomes more of a serious infection. But either way, it needs to be treated with antibiotics.
What actually causes urinary tract infection, Zach?
It is from bacteria. It's usually the gut bacteria, basically, that manage to climb up from the outside and get into the urinary tract. And usually urine is sterile, so usually there's no bacteria at all in urine. But if the bacteria get in there and have a chance to fester, then people get symptoms. And that's why some of the recommendations for preventing urinary tract infections are things to make sure that, well, there's a couple of things. One is to make sure that you have enough fluids. So you keep, the less you pee, the less anything kind of sits around, mm-hmm. the better. So if any bacteria has a chance to sit around in your bladder, then it has more chance to cause an infection. Same way, if your blood isn't moving, it's not very good for you. You know, so anyway, that's why it's recommended that people take in enough fluids. And then the other thing is you want to do things, so mainly that means water, by the way, drinking lots of water. And then you want to pee when you need to, so don't hold it in all day, for example. And other things include things like wiping, especially when you have a bowel movement, to wipe from front to back so you're not potentially contaminating the urinary area with the bacteria from your guts. And there's some other recommendations also, like, you know, especially for women, peeing after they have intercourse, or avoiding certain things like feminine hygiene sprays and things that can be irritative to the urethra. There was one other one that I'm trying. Oh yeah, shower is generally better than bath in terms of not helping a urinary tract to progress.
Okay. And I know you mentioned earlier kidney stones. I've always sort of not really understood how they actually come about and who's sort of susceptible to them.
Oh, yeah. So kidney stones are quite common. I don't have a number, but, you know, certainly working in the emergency room, we see them all the time. You know, certainly every day someone comes in with a kidney stone, and they can be at any age. They can occur in men and in women. They don't, they're certainly more common in adults than they are in children. And risk, and they do occur more commonly in men than they do in women, but they certainly can occur in both. And basically, you know, they're basically, there's all these toxins, and there's these different chemicals that are in the kidneys that are usually flushed out in urine. But sometimes if the urine sits around for too long, or if there's too much of certain things like calcium or uric acid, a little stone can form, and these aren't big stones. These aren't these aren't several centimeters big. They can be even just a couple of millimeters. But this region, the tubes are all quite small. So even like a 3-4 millimeter stone can cause a lot of pain, because basically, so you develop this hard stone, which is pretty much what it is, and then it tries to be flushed out in the urine. But because the ureters, the tubes for the urine are quite small or tight, they can sometimes get stuck. And even if they're not stuck, every time the body tries to push them out, it can be painful, because it can stretch these tubes, which have pain receptors. And so they can be very severely painful, even if they're just a few millimeters big. The vast majority of them do pass on their own, meaning without any surgery or anything. But as they get bigger, then there's more and more chance that they could potentially not pass on their own, in which case you'd need some kind of procedure. Urologists have a number of procedures for getting the big ones out that won't come out on their own.
And, you know, I don't often hear about this, but I'm sure that you guys do as doctors. Urinary incontinence, what does that mean? And does that affect sort of people of all ages, or is that mainly like an older problem?
Well, so urinary incontinence, it means basically the leaking of urine when you don't want it to, you know. So it's having a pee even though you don't want to. And it certainly can happen at any age. You're right that it's more common as people get older, and especially, you know, as men and women get older, they tend to have different problems. Problems can happen to anyone, but like urinary incontinence is more common in women as they get older, especially women who have had multiple babies, because it changes the anatomy and some of the muscles may stretch somewhat. And the opposite is true in men. So urinary retention, which basically means the urine is blocked and can't get out, that's more common in men, usually because as men get older, they have an enlarging prostate. And so that, you know, that can basically block the exit of the urine. So, but they're very common problems. It's those two especially, you know, the other things we talked about, like kidney stones and urinary tract infections, are pretty, you know, people aren't usually shy to talk about them. And I think most people know that they exist and they're treatable. Whereas urinary incontinence and the urinary retention are very, very common, but people are really more embarrassed to talk about them, I think. So they may talk about them with their doctor, but they may, you know, it's not as well known that it's very common, especially as we get older, to have both of those problems.
When you were mentioning the part about women and multiple births and how that might affect things, should you, as a younger woman, be doing those, what is it, Kegel exercises, like throughout your life to sort of maybe help yourself as you get older?
Well, it's not, I mean, I don't think they'll hurt. There aren't any clear recommendations that young women or women without any symptoms should necessarily be doing Kegel exercises, but I think it's a good thing that people, you know, it's just good that people know what those things are. And, you know, they're basically just exercises to increase the muscle tone and increase the muscle control down in the pelvic muscles. And that is exactly one of the treatments for people who are having difficulties with urinary incontinence. I think, in general, more important for women, you know, younger women, is to see their doctor regularly for things like pap tests and discussions about sexually transmitted infections. Because those are things, you know, certainly those are more common and also you're very treatable, but if they're not treated, then it can lead to problems down the road.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Dr. Zach Levine, an ER physician at the Montreal General Hospital. I'm glad you actually brought up the sexually transmitted diseases. Which ones should sort of be really at the forefront of our minds, like, and to sort of be aware of?
Well, certainly the most common ones that we see are still chlamydia and gonorrhea. And those are both bacterial, so meaning that you treat them with antibiotics. There are a number of other ones that are sexually transmitted that are from viruses, and I'm sure people are familiar with things like herpes or other things, including HPV, which has gotten more media attention recently, human papillomavirus, which causes warts but also is associated with cervical cancer. And then other things, including hepatitis and HIV and syphilis, which are less common than things like gonorrhea and chlamydia. I'm talking about syphilis and HIV, but certainly syphilis has apparently been making something of a comeback. It's increased its rates recently. And HPV is quite common. That's something that a lot of people are exposed to. So there are a bunch of different ones, and they present in different ways, and a lot of them can be screened for. And one of the things that's worth noting is that a number of them, you may have no symptoms. You know, you may have these infections and not even know you have them. So that's why people are encouraged to get screened, even if they have no symptoms.
And with regards to some of these things, like, what would you tell, like, you know, a guy or a woman, like, they really, especially, I guess, if they're sort of a little all over the place with their sexual partners, they really need to be aware. Like, how often should they be getting tested?
Well, I think at a minimum, I think it's worthwhile to see your doctor annually, just to see them and potentially, you know, you can. There are different recommendations. So for pap tests specifically, which is, it's not specifically a test for sexually transmitted infection, but that is where they take the cells from the cervix and they see if there's any cancer, and that's related to HPV, which we talked about before, which there is a vaccine for that's now offered in school. So that's actually a good step forward. So PAPs now, they used to say you should have one every year. Now some people are saying if you're with a stable partner, you can have one every 2 years or every 3 years, but and less frequently is probably okay. However, you're right. If you're changing partners often, then testing for sexually transmitted infections, which, by the way, is not that bad anymore. You know, you don't have to have a swab anymore. For example, the testing is for chlamydia and gonorrhea. The test is now, it can be done in a urine test. It used to be a swab, which both for men and for women, you know, neither were very happy to have those things done, obviously. Mm-hmm. But now it can be done in a urine test. And for the other ones, so I'm talking about syphilis and HIV and hepatitis, those are a blood test. And so those, if you're having, you know, multiple partners, and certainly if you're having multiple partners and not using any form of barrier contraception, it's important to keep in mind that, you know, even if you're on the pill or some kind of contraceptive, the only one that's actually going to protect you from some of the sexually transmitted infections is a barrier, so meaning a condom. And so if you are having multiple partners and not using protection, then it's worth getting checked regularly, you know, and especially sometimes people will come to the clinic as a couple, a new couple, and they've been with other people and they've discussed it and they just decided, you know, we're both going to get tested before we start to be intimate, just to make sure that neither of us have anything. And that's a reasonable idea.
I wanted to ask you with regards to chlamydia and gonorrhea, if you contract that, are you susceptible to it sort of in the future, even if you get rid of it?
Well, people who have had it have a little bit higher risk of having it again, but it's not actually that they're susceptible to it. It's just, I think, you know, people who are more sexually active or more sexually active without protection are maybe at higher risk of catching it again. However, the good news is that those two are they're bacterial and they are completely curable. So if you do get tested, like, so first of all, if you do have symptoms, so symptoms can be things like burning when you pee or an abnormal discharge or pain when you have sex. So if you have any of those symptoms and you get tested, or if you're just screened, meaning you don't have any symptoms but you have the test for it and it's positive, then treatment with antibiotics will get rid of it 100%, so it's cured. So that's the nice thing, as opposed to a lot of viruses which aren't necessarily curable, things like the things we mentioned, you know, like herpes and HIV, and those are viruses, so they can be treated for sure, but cure means it's gone unless you catch it again. So like you mentioned, chlamydia and gonorrhea, they are curable. You take an antibiotic, they go away. Same with syphilis, by the way. But you can catch them again for sure. But you aren't necessarily more susceptible unless you go back to the same behavior that caused it. So unless you have sex with a new partner and you don't use protection again, then your risk is just as much as it was when you had it before.
Now, I know you mentioned the vaccine for HPV. Who can actually end up contracting that situation?
So HPV is very common. Like, the majority of people have been exposed to it. And like I mentioned, it stands for human papillomavirus. It's the cause of genital warts, and it's clearly associated with cervical cancer. And there's some evidence that it's also associated with penile cancer. So it's certainly not just a woman's problem in terms of cancer. And obviously, both men and women can get genital warts. So it is something now, presently, in most places in North America, certainly in Quebec, the vaccine is covered for women, for young women, and is actually offered in school. There's two injections. They're talking about making it available also for men, or at least covered for men, and also available for men, but it hasn't started here. In some places, I believe it has. But basically, because it's so prevalent and because it's associated with cancer, it's very important to get this vaccine, which has actually been shown. There are a lot of different strains of this virus, so like many, many different types of the virus. But the thing about the vaccine is they chose the ones that are most commonly associated with cancer. So you're being protected from the types of that virus that are most likely to cause cervical cancer. So it is worthwhile getting the vaccine. It's still worthwhile using barrier protection as well, like a condom. But it's great to have this protection. And they're offering it at the young age, hopefully to vaccinate people before they're sexually active.
Now, I wanted to ask you as well about cancers. Yeah, you've been sort of mentioning them, but with regards to the urinary system, like prostate, bladder, kidney, what do you want us to be aware of with regards to that?
Yeah, it's important to be aware of them. And they're, you know, different ages are susceptible to different cancers. And then obviously there are male cancers and female cancers, like the prostate. Prostate cancer is only in men because women don't have a prostate, and tends to be something that develops more with age. So it's not a young man's cancer, as opposed to something like testicular cancer, which is certainly more common in young men. And in women, the women's cancers are obviously the gynecologic things. And so I mentioned earlier cervical cancer, and that's one of the few cancers that we have actually a really good screening test for. That's the Pap smear. By screening test, I mean a test that a doctor can do before someone has any kind of symptoms, pick up just the earliest signs of a cancer, so you can cure it easily. And that's great. For most cancers, we don't have that. But the good thing is for cervical cancer, we do. And then the other ones that both men and women can have are bladder cancer and kidney cancer. So what I would say is, I mean, it's important to talk to your doctor, and depending on your age and your gender, you can discuss what screening tests are available and what you should look for. In general, if you have any kind of changes that you notice, so I'm talking about blood in your urine, for example, pain when you have intercourse, any kind of unusual discharge, any kind of unusual lumps or bumps that you can't explain that are getting bigger that and that aren't going away, you know, anything like that that you're concerned about is worth getting checked out, because, you know, they may very well be benign. Everything I mentioned, burning on urination or blood in the urine, you know, these things can definitely be caused by infections. They can be caused by stones, but you don't know for sure unless you have it checked out. And the thing about cancer specifically, I mean, there are many things in medicine with it, which this is true for, including infections, but cancer in particular, you really want to catch it early so that you have the best chance of curing it. And so if you have any kind of symptom that is worrisome to you that you've noticed is different, because we all know our own body, so we can say whether something is different or not normal for us. If you notice that, then it's worthwhile at least checking it out with your doctor and just seeing. Maybe you'll just be reassured, but then they can just do a test, or they can tell you, okay, it's nothing. Or if it is something, they can treat it early on.
Dr. Zach, thank you so much. It's always so great to talk to you about this. You always make us feel better about life. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Kelly.
That's Dr. Zach Levine, an ER physician at the Montreal General Hospital.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Hanging out with us on the Kelly Alexander Show is recording artist Sabel, who started his journey in British Columbia but has worked on his music in amazing places like Nashville and Los Angeles. Sabel, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So did you always know from, like, childhood that a career in music was for you?
Ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to do music. I wanted to sing, and pretty much any chance I got to sing for people, I took it. So it was a pretty natural progression from a childhood dream to, you know, to a bona fide career.
Would you say that the environment that you were in, like the town you were in, was conducive to starting a music career, or was it a bit of a challenge?
I was born in a town called Smithers, BC, which is way up north of the boonies, which is pretty much known for, like, logging industry and like, skiing.
Mm-hmm.
So it definitely was a musical town. But I pretty much grew up in small towns my whole life, and I think that the thing that really helped that and really fostered that talent is my family. They loved music, and they really cared about music, so they really instilled that in me. It was very much part of my family's culture, maybe not a part of the culture of the towns I grew up in, but very much part of the family culture.
And when it comes to instrumentation and musical instruments, which instrument do you gravitate towards, or is there a couple?
Typically, it all starts on the piano. I don't really play any other instruments, but I do, like, I build my own kind of drum grooves and that kind of stuff, you know, in Pro Tools and Logic. I do a lot of that kind of stuff, some programming and stuff. But, it's all started at the piano. I can play, like, two chords on guitar, but that doesn't get me very far.
How do you actually go about creating your songs? Is it like a solo endeavor, or do you like to bounce ideas off of like a writing partner?
It's typically solo. The song Sunburns Out was actually the single Sunburns Out was a song that I worked on with my producer Jeremy Lapido in Nashville, and I had written the song, came to him with a piano vocal, and that he kind of built a groove around it, and basically built the foundation and then we cut a vocal to it, and it was very collaborative and, you know, in the production sense, but the song was written before I entered the studio with him, so it was kind of, that's usually how it works for me. It's not that I'm a loner, but I write my best songs at not optimal times, at like 4 a.m, so not a lot of guys want to do a co-writing session at that time. So.
Gotcha. Can you talk to us about the Sabel Project, because obviously that's your last name. Why did you choose to go with just that as opposed to both names?
You know what? I had a career under the name Greg Sabel, my full name, and the spelling of my last name is always problematic because it's Polish and we like consonants. And so there's a lot of, you know, Z's and C's and stuff like that in my name. And So no one could really say my name, so there's always that. But also, it's just I've been doing this for a while now and had kind of built a good career as a songwriter and had done some stuff in the country music scene. I actually toured with Canadian country artist Paul Brandt for about the last, 7 years. He's a good friend. But I just felt like I needed to have a fresh start and kind of press reset on my career. I had a lot of great success as an indie artist under the name Greg Sobel, but it was time to just kind of cleanse the palate creatively. And also, to be able to hide behind, not hide so much, but to be able to work behind the name Sobel rather than my own name. It kind of like, when it's you and it's your name and your face, it's so personal. It's so hard to step back from it and be objective. I think the Sobel brand allows me to kind of treat it like a band almost, and I can there's a little more freedom in that. It's not me. It's not me personally. It's a project, and it's really cool.
Talk to us about the song "Till the Sun Burns Out." You mentioned before sort of how it came about, but why do you think it's being so successful? Because you're getting great radio play, and I definitely feel like it's one of those songs that sort of sticks with you.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that really it has to do with the fans and radio that's hopped on board. They've been so supportive of it. And without that, I wouldn't be able to do what I've done. It's really been a process of just seeing people hop on board that have adopted it early. I don't know. At the end of the day, I really try to write pop songs that mean something, that hit the heart, that are, and this song, it's a love song. It's romantic, but it also has a feel good, sunshiny feel to it. And so I think that connects with the fans too. I think that everyone falls in and out of love at one time or another, and so they can relate to that. So I hope that's what it is. I hope that that's what's causing people to connect with it. And it's been exciting. It's been really exciting to see it so well with the fans and with radio.
Can we expect a full length album? Now that the single's out, is there like a full album coming through this project?
Yeah, for sure. I've been working on a full length for a while now. I think we're going to release an EP first and just kind of launch a few songs at a time, just to kind of give people a chance to take it in at a comfortable pace, not be like, hey, here's a whole CD, now you have to sift through all of this and see what you like. But it also gives me a chance to really kind of test the waters and see what works and see what the fans gravitate to. A lot of times you can spend, I'm an independent artist. I pretty much am the record label and I'm the artist and the songwriter. And it's all, I have a team that helps me with the promotion and that side of things, but it pretty much, it's all starting from here. So if I can kind of test things out rather than, spending the money on a full length album right out of the gate, it's almost a wiser way to go, because it allows me to see what fans like to hear, what they want to hear more of.
What's on tap for you for the rest of 2014? Like, is it finishing the EP and then touring, or like, are we going to expect some live shows from you before the year's out?
Yeah, I hope so. I'll be in the studio for the next few months, pretty busy with that. We just finished two music videos in LA, and we're filming some more in the next couple months for more singles. And just really trying to release a lot of songs and just get that into people's iPods. And and beyond that, once we have some singles out on radio and online, I'd love to collaborate with some other artists. And I'd love to hop on tour and do some Canadian tours for sure.
Awesome. Well, Sobel, thank you so much. It's been so great to talk to you, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
That's Sobel. Make sure to check him out on his website, sobelmusic.com.
Hey, this is Sobel hanging out in the Kelly Alexander Show.
I'm walked to your door 100 nights before. And I'll walk you to the end of the world. 'Cause you're falling into love. It's heaven's wonder drug. I'm addicted, and only you can fix me, girl. I'm gonna love you till the sun burns out. Love you till the sun burns out. And I'll chase away.
burns out.
Us on the show this week, and a big thank you going out to my guests, Bobby Schwartz, Patrick Charles, Dr. Zach Levine, and musician Sibel. Here is your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time coming from William S. Burroughs. In the magical universe, there are no coincidences and there are no accidents. Nothing happens unless someone wills it to happen. Thank you so much again for hanging out. Please check us out on our social media, on Twitter, at Kay Alexander Show. Of course, on Facebook, Kelly Alexander Show. And our interviews on YouTube, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.